Hey everyone, this episode of the Cracked Podcast was brought to you by Piper. Get security without the fees and better yet, without the security companies. Check out Piper, an all-in-one home security and home automation system packed with the camera, multiple environmental sensors, and even a blaring siren. Get notified when motion or sound is detected and see exactly what's going on directly from your mobile device with encrypted live or recorded HD videos. It's easy to use and there's no wiring required. Starting from $199, you'll have a security system that you can customize to focus on exactly what matters to you. Go to getpiper.com/cracked and collect $25 off any Piper or Piper bundle. It's me, Daniel, not Jack O'Brien. O'Brien filling in again for Jack. Jack O'Brien O'Brien, who is out of town. He is in Germany, competing in an underground high-stakes yo-yo competition that boasts no rules, apart from, of course, the many varied and nuanced rules of standard yo-yo warfare. Speaking of rules, I am and have been a tremendous fan of rules. It's possible that it stems from a lifetime of social awkwardness. If a situation is governed by clear, followable rules, it'll be much easier for me to hang. There are do's and don'ts, restrictions and strategies, and as long as I follow the rules, I can't be wrong or ridiculed. It's what makes me awful at parties and absolutely lethal at board games. It's also possible that my love of rules comes from wanting to figure everything out all the time. As a kid, that manifests itself in thought puzzles and riddles and video games, but as I got older and started to turn towards writing and comedy, it became really important to me to figure out why something was funny or how one episode of a sitcom or screenplay worked while another one didn't. It wasn't enough for me to just like things. I wanted to know what, on a structural level, made The Simpsons work, or why the best jokes were the best jokes. It's not just appreciating a thing, I wanted to know the rules. Rules are everywhere, not just in jokes and TV shows and movies, but all over the friggin' place. And so I sat down with a couple of my coworkers and forced them to talk about rules with me for an hour, because I am senior management at this company, which means people have to do what I say, which is yet another reason why I love rules so much. Okay, let's do the podcast. I'll check in with you again later at Footnotes! We all have to say it that way. She said, "You've been pushing me like I was a sore tooth. You can't respect me because I've done so much for you." He said, "Well, I hate that it's come to this. But baby, I was doing fine. Now do you think that I survived the other 25 before you? Shalala, shalala, lala, the end is growing." Hey, it's me, Daniel O'Brien, and I'm joined by two of my co-workers who have to be here. Soren Bowie.
Ouch. I would say friend first, then coworker.
Yeah.
We didn't meet at a schoolyard, Soren. We met at this building. We met at this office at a lunch that you were forced to attend.
Yeah. And then we became best buddies.
No. Rules dictate that whatever context you meet, that's what you are forever.
Okay. I met Alex in a hotel room.
Yeah. I met all of you guys in a hotel room,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, that's true.
Like a swanky one in New York City, like an impress somebody hotel room.
Yeah, yeah. And do we have a clip of that hotel? Can we roll that clip?
Okay, fan noise. Fan noise.
Different
really
medium.
Wanted to promote that.
Alex Schmidt hotel. Also here.
Yeah. Hey, great
Alex
to be
Schmidt.
Here.
Yeah, thanks for doing this thing that I demanded you both do. Speaking of demands, we're going to talk about rules today and how much I like rules. And I've loved rules my entire life, but I got the idea to want to talk about this since I could do whatever I want because Jack is gone. He is in Haiti right now, tearing down a lot of the houses that other people have built. For Habitat for Humanity. It's really strange, but he's dedicated to it, and I just like to see this kind of passion.
As soon as there are no rules, Dan just wants to talk about rules.
Yeah. But separate from that, Alex has just wrapped up his show, New Guy Weekly, for the Cracked YouTube channel, which is a phenomenal show, and he's doing bunch of posts talking... Do not interrupt me again. Doing a bunch of posts talking about it, and one of the posts led him to put up Chuck Jones's rules for Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons, which I remember seeing a long time ago and was just completely fascinated by them. Alex, would you like to read out these rules with your deep baritone, your meaningful...
Well, that's just mean.
You want me to read them? Yeah, should I read them all out for the listeners? At home?
Yeah, I was going to read them all out.
This is a 9-rule list. The way it was introduced to me, it was in like a nice, little nicely designed document, so I think Chuck Jones like actually had it made. But anyway... Rule number one, and these are all for the Roadrunner and Wile E specifically, Chuck Jones' rule number one is that the Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going beep beep. That's the only thing he can do. Rule number two, no outside force can harm the coyote, only his own ineptitude or the failure of the Acme products. Rule number three, the coyote could stop any time. if he were not a fanatic. Then in parentheses here, there's a quote, a fanatic is one who redoubles his effort when he has forgotten his aim, George Santayana. Rule number four, no dialogue ever except for beep beep.
Only because this is the second time it's come up, I'm going to jump in that among the many things that I learned from this list was that the Roadrunner has not been saying meep meep this whole time. Am I the only one for whom this is news?
Do you know anything about birds at all? Like, do you?
It does seem meep meep.
Meep meep. Yeah. Meep.
Yeah, it does feel like a hard M.
It does feel like a meep.
Right off the bat, Chuck's breaking his own rules.
Rule number five, the Roadrunner must stay on the road. Otherwise, logically, he would not be called Roadrunner. Again, basic bird facts. Rule number six, all action must be confined to the natural environment of the two characters, the Southwest American desert. Rule number seven, all materials, tools, weapons, or mechanical conveniences must be obtained from the Acme Corporation. Rule number eight, whenever possible, make gravity the coyote's greatest enemy. And then rule number nine, last rule, the coyote is always more humiliated than harmed by his failures.
All right, already these rules break each other. I just now noticed that rule number two, no outside force can harm the coyote, only his own ineptitude and the failure of the Acme products. And then rule number eight is whenever possible. Also, just gravity fucks him up a lot.
Yeah, well, I think they work in concert usually. It's usually like he's purchased a rocket sled or a catapult that is not physics's friend.
Yeah.
It's not something that's going to work out.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that send him up in the air, which, as far as I can tell, the Roadrunner doesn't fly.
No.
He's just running. But every time that he goes wrong in the third dimension.
There's a whole lot to unpack with this list. For one, it's such an elegant and clean way for anyone to ever write a Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoon. Like, unless he did this with the guise of time, which is also possible. It's possible that he created all the cartoons and was like, oh, you know what? Here are some rules. But I like to think that he did this at like the inception of Coyote and Roadrunner. And it's just so, to have that kind of vision for like, this is exactly what I want to say with the show. And it's in the simplest and most plain language. And it's all true. It's true of almost every Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoon. And it's just so clean the way he did this. And it's still, once you follow these rules, you could do anything. You have, now Coyote is in a bat suit. Now he's eating earthquake pills that blow up his stomach. And now he's painting on a fucking wall. And you just get to go so outlandish while still staying grounded by all these rules. It's just such a testament to...
I like the implications of him as well. That the Roadrunner can only harm him by saying beep beep means that the Roadrunner has no malicious intention throughout any of this. That you can maintain this character who's just dumb. I mean, couldn't care less about anything, and has always felt confident in his safety.
It's nine rules that tell you how every episode of a show works, exactly what both of these characters are like, and it's a show that is one of the most famous and recognizable and universal shows in the history of cartoons. And nine rules, this fucking, and no dialogue in these shows, except for when Coyote and Bugs Bunny talked, because then he was super genius. And
there are, because part of what got me really into Looney Tunes and these in particular is my dad loving them, and my dad loved to quote Wile E. Coyote super genius like all of the time, and I was like, wait a minute, that's the one thing he's ever said. But I think by having these rules, it makes it easier to break them on the few times you do, because then you're doing it consciously, then you know, okay, there is a specific reason I'm breaking this rule, and I know why I've put some thought into it.
Right, you need that foundation before you can start to deviate from it. So people are always like, why would you create rules, why would you have to, why would you like inhibit yourself in your show that you're just now creating? It's like, no, the rules are the foundation of this house, and then you can build whatever the hell you want on top of it. And if you want to add a little garage that extends beyond the foundation, that's fine too. Now you can do that because the rest of it supports it.
That's how you can have Wile E. Coyote accidentally shoot himself into space and die in space. That's not technically the American Southwest, but that's like, but who cares, we got the coyote in space. Isn't that a real coup? Isn't that neat for us? Actually, seeing these, because I have an absurd mind for cartoons, instead of whatever Soren, who has a wife and child on the way, has in his brain that makes him balanced.
Probably my house analogy, I think.
In, I think, 1999, in like a Looney Tunes-style reboot kind of thing, they did a prequel Coyote and Roadrunner thing. It's not Tiny Toons, it's when they're children. And Coyote has a dad. And it might be the mom, but I'm pretty sure it's the dad. Says that, Wile E, you're not allowed to speak until you've caught your first Roadrunner. And then the episode is just like these two tots of Coyote and Roadrunner trying to outrun each other. And the coyote doesn't get it. And the dad looks to camera at the end and is like, he's not going to be speaking for a very long time. Wink. And that destroys all of Chuck Jones's rules. Because now it's not, here is the Roadrunner, who's this, like, Sorensen, this doofy goofball. Because for all we know, meep meep means hello, or what are you looking at?
Yeah.
And this Coyote, who's... greatest crime is his fanaticism and his hubris. Now, none of that's true. Now, Coyote is this tragic figure who is just trying to catch the Roadrunner so he can eat and speak for the first time in his life. Because we can assume, if this is canon, yeah, he has not been eating his entire life.
And that was 1999 or so?
That was 1999, yeah.
There must have been something in the water, because that's around when midichlorians got rolled out. So, like just things that retroactively ruin things I love so much, just wow. Logically.
It's also much, much sadder that way, because you think about it from an artist perspective who's making it, that what that actually means metaphorically, that before you can find your voice,
yeah,
you have to, like, destroy this one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is really horrible. And horrible, I thought when you were saying horrible for the artist, I thought you were talking about Chuck Jones and just thinking that this is just someone's nephew who's taken over Wile E. Coyote now. Just someone who's like, you know, just some fucking cracked employee who's like, you know, I wonder why the coyote's never spoken. I'm going to give a backstory to make sense of all this. Yeah. And then just ruin everything that's come before.
Trying to retcon it, yeah, and ended up destroying it. I can understand that. You get very precious with the things that you spent so long working on. Yeah. We do that occasionally with After Hours, where we have such a set rule, a set of rules for what After Hours is among the people who make the show. This is Cracked After Hours, by the way, if you only listen to the podcast.
It's not that that short-lived Playboy TV show.
It's not that one. But when other people then write episodes, there are points in it where you're like, no, what are you doing? You're destroying everything just because you want to add to it. You can't do that. And getting very, very precious about it.
Right. Well, After Hours is a good segue, because jumping off from the Chuck Jones Coyote Roadrunner thing makes me obsessed about what are the rules for all shows. I want to find, like, what needs to happen in every show. And to also see who has borrowed from Chuck Jones at this point. But After Hours, we'll bring up, because that show started as rules. That show wasn't get Soren, Dan, Michael, and Katie in a room together and just have them riff. Like, the very first script that we had was person one, person two, person three, person four. And we sat in, I think, Jack's aunt's garage.
Her
pool house, yeah. I'm trying to make it seem like we're fucking Wozniak or something like that. Like, just born in this garage. But that was just, her pool house was really nice, and it was a great place to hang out. We had pizza, and we just decided, okay, there's one of these people reacts to everything from pop culture from the very base level. It's sex or it's food. It's a need. And that's Michael. That's all of his arguments stem from the sexual or the base or the how can I make this something I can have sex with in some way. There's not a whole lot to
it. Yeah, just it's anything carnal and visceral. Yeah. Like that's his only interest in stuff. Sure. Is it the id?
Yeah. So, another character that ended up being me was going to be very much the thinking things through as far as they could possibly be thought through. It was the overthinking guy, overanalytical. This is how they view everything. There's no emotional component to it. There's certainly no sexual component to it. It's just information comes in and I'm going to dig into it as much as possible. Katie was the
pragmatic reason. Her character was somebody who handles everything from a very clinical and objective standpoint that puts absolutely no investment or stock into how people would actually feel about these things.
Right.
And so it comes off very cold and crass about them.
Yeah, it was always very important that she is unmoved by the evils of man. She was like, I'm going to just put it out there for you. And then the Soren character was
just a cool dude.
Cool guy, yeah.
The way that I always saw it was, that's your access point to the show. So where everybody else is, they are caricatures of, like, the way that the extremes of how you and your friends would actually talk about these things. There's one character who is you'd actually probably hang out with. You'd be fine hanging out with him.
Yeah. None of the others, though.
Yeah.
It's that's that show before we even decided who was going to play whom. It was, here are the four points of view of this show, and then you could just sort of attack anything. And we did. Then it's just put Batman through each of these filters, put history through each of these filters, da 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 da. We sort of moved a little bit beyond that because that's how time goes, but there's still, I think that's at the core what makes
and at
the
any
rules
point,
of that show.
When we started to think about, when we tried to, like, build narratives for the people in the show, we cut that shit up pretty quick because we were like, well, no, the show has to be governed by whatever we're talking about. It's
right.
If pop you notice, culture that is the main character.
If you notice the first few episodes, Michael has a character trait where he's always bringing food from home and also always taking other people's food and, like, putting it in a plastic bag. Like, episode one, he drinks from a water jug and has his own bag of chicken in a Ziploc bag or something. And we also spent a couple episodes talking about the off-screen relationship that happened once between Michael and Katie. And then we just blew all that up. We just stopped doing it because it wasn't part of the rules of the show.
But you find that when you are very sparing, or at least we did when with the show, is that when you find you're very sparing with what people actually do and what they're like, and like the long-standing jokes that come back and things like that, and that the actual characters of these people, that people appreciate them more, that when they do see them, it means more. So like people will start to find these things that Dan does frequently throughout the show, because now they're so much easier to isolate because there are so few of them and who this person actually is.
Yeah, like I get the sense that like fans of any show that sticks to rules so strongly like that, like I knew as somebody who'd watched all of them, like I got those rules without having been told them, and also without that Wile E. Coyote's parents moment of like, well, Soren, time to be the coolest boy in the world. Like, no, you don't need that at all if you just stick to it and have those bones there. And
Soren, catch this roadrunner, or don't. Whatever you do, it's going to be right.
And we were talking about the coyote. Another movie that I really appreciate a lot more knowing about coyotes is Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler's movie just came out recently with Jake Gyllenhaal, where he's trying to start his own business, taking video or videotaping. That's the one. Videotaping.
Yeah, news footage. Yeah,
basically accidents, murders, anything that's worthy of a news cycle. And so, in an interview that he did, he talked about how they agreed very early on that they wanted him to just be like a wild animal, and then they landed on the coyote, and how perfect that is for Los Angeles. If anybody has been to Los Angeles, that there's this weird subconscious of Los Angeles that's represented in these coyotes that just show up occasionally here. That when you're walking through the city and if you're in the hills of Silver Lake or Hollywood or Beechwood Canyon, you'll eventually just run into a coyote for no reason. And they live here, and they've adapted to the city, and they always look like they're starving. Jake Gyllenhaal lost 30 pounds for that movie.
That's the thing about coyotes, that growing up I knew them from cartoons, and like they seemed like a threat anytime there was a movie with people in the wilderness and a dog. Like a pack of coyotes would come, and they had that ominous howling that if you heard a coyote howling, you were legitimately scared. And now the time that I've seen coyotes has been at the gates outside of my dog park, and it just looks like this sick, shitty, gaunt skeleton thing that is just like, if things were different, I'd eat one of your tiny dogs.
Right, it looks so ineffectual, especially when you see them alone, and we've been so conditioned to look at dogs as these loving creatures, that when you see them, they're not so different from dogs. They're very, very skinny. They look like they need help.
Yeah.
But then you listen to them at night and you hear them tearing apart a deer.
Yeah.
And so like they are very, very dangerous, but they don't look it immediately. Yeah.
Well, and you're surprised to see them in LA because you forget that the city's kind of sort of built on a desert. Like it's kind of built, if we hadn't pumped all this water into the area, it would look a lot more like those spaces that he's chasing a roadrunner in.
Yeah, there are still these wild creatures living in an urban environment, and especially wild predators living in an urban environment is startling whenever you see them.
It was always kind of funny that he was just hanging out on the outside of this fenced-in area full of dogs running with abandon, and there are all these humans here, so he's just sitting there looking at it like, this is fucked. This is just totally unfair. This is my wild, and here's a cage full of things I eat, but I can't do anything about it.
The reason that really stuck with me with Nightcrawler was because when I was a child, I grew up in Colorado, in sort of the woods of Colorado, and our neighbors at one point had puppies, and the puppies were allowed to play in the yard. And we were just at their house one day, and we saw one of the puppies out in the field playing with this coyote. And we're like, what a majestic moment this puppy is playing with this coyote. And the coyote keeps like running away from the puppy, like the puppy's dangerous to it, and getting further and further away. And then my friend's mom came out with a gun, a .22, and shot the coyote. And we were like, why would you do that? And she's like, he's luring the puppy away. That's what they do. They'll lure it out past into the woods, and then the other coyotes are just waiting there to eviscerate this puppy.
And that's what, I haven't seen Nightcrawler. That's the plot, though. He lures a puppy and
he lures a puppy away. Yeah.
Yeah.
And eats it.
And your friend's mom shoots Jake Gyllenhaal.
Spoilers. Spoilers.
But that's what I do feel like, because we're going to talk about other shows that have clear rules the way that Coyote and Roadrunner do. But I think another thing that has happened in like modern television has been rules have sort of been replaced by points of view. Each character represents a certain point of view, because we're living in an age where TV shows, like the premise of a sitcom, gets blown up all the time. Parks and Rec will jump forward in the future, and people will switch jobs. So it's less and less, like that show, more than any, except maybe Larry Sanders or Soap, were huge about, we don't care, we're going to throw out our show and do a new show right now. And Parks and Rec, I feel like, is very strong for, instead of rules, Ron Swanson has this point of view. Leslie Knope has this point of view.
Right.
Retta has this point of view. Or Donna, rather, has this point of view. Everyone has their, like, this is the one sentence about who I am. And then once you have that, it's just like Chuck Jones's rules. Then it's just, well, now you put these two points of view in a room, and you put Tom Haverford and Ben in a room, and the show just sort of happens that way.
Yeah, and you see that with Community especially, too. Like, yeah. It's so... The premise of the show is almost, now it'll be paintball this week, and now it'll be Vikings this week, and whatever they do. But since we know what those, like, seven or eight people are into every time, we'll get there.
But Community is a good one to bring up, because Dan Harmon is sort of famous for his story structure wheel. Dan Harmon, for anyone who doesn't know, he created Community and runs the live show and podcast Harmontown. And you're lying, you know who Dan Harmon is. But before all that, he was worked on Channel 101, which is just people submit pilots to he and a couple of friends.
Rob Schrall.
A duo that became a community of people. And there'd be screenings and there'd be feedback on your things. It was like before YouTube when people were just like, here's my pilot. And if your pilot won that month, you're allowed to go to the next screening with episode two of your show. And I think they'd seen so many bad pilots, because that's what happens when you invite the whole world to submit shows to you, that he, in the forums of Channel 101, just did a very, the super basic shit story structure that he put out, which is, I will now read to you. It's a circle, and he has applied it to every pilot that he's done, and every show that he's done, and every episode of every show that he's done. 1. A character is in a zone of comfort. 2. But they want something. 3. They enter an unfamiliar situation. 4. Adapt to it. 5. Get what they wanted. 6. Pay a heavy price for it. 7. Then return to their familiar situation. 8. Having changed. But I think about that, you could see that you can, if you want, look at any Community episode and chart every single bit of it. And it's true of most of your favorite movies also. Thomas Lennon and Robert Ben Garin have a simpler version of it in their book, How to Write Screenplays for Fun and Profit, with fun crossed out. And it's man goes up a tree, people throw rocks at him, man comes down from the tree. Having changed. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like Chuck Jones's rules incredibly simple, and there's no way that you know, you've seen Star Wars. There's a lot that goes into stories and movies. It can't be just that. But you can look at, they hold up Die Hard a lot as their favorite, and that's man goes up a tree as man is in this tower in this unfamiliar situation. People are throwing rocks at him. He's getting shot. He's walking on broken glass. No one's listening to him. He comes down from the tree. He saves the day. The terrorists are dead, and he's changed now. He and his wife have reconnected. He's learned the thing that he was supposed to learn when he was up in that fucking tree.
Yeah, he even went literally upward. Like, he went up into a giant tower, and that's, and you just watch him in the tower from the parking lot with the cops, the whole thing. Like, oh, look at him go in that tree. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Every single story, it's always, it's about returning to homeostasis. It's never about changing the world or anything like that. It's about maintaining what you have now. This is the best there is. And things will get bad for a little bit, but we're going to get back to what we were before.
Yeah.
Like, that's the message that we get from every single story ever told. That's fairy tales. That's everything.
Yeah. And you notice those things when they don't, whether it's noticing that a character breaks what their point of view is, or they break a rule of, like, what, they walk on the thing and, like, I'm John Wayne and this is how I am. And if they suddenly deviate from that and it's not for effect, you notice it. And that's what makes a bad movie, or a bad TV show, a bad TV show. Like, you notice Chekhov's gun a lot. That is, like, a standout bad screenwriting thing to me. Chekhov's gun, for anyone who doesn't know, is if there's a gun in the first act, then it needs to go off in the final act.
Third.
And that's based on a Chekhov play where there was a gun hanging at, over someone's fireplace.
No, I think it's... No.
Seagull, maybe?
Somebody wrote it. Yeah, I think it was probably Seagull. But everybody talks about it from... It's not even his play, but Death of a Salesman. There's, like, oh, there's a gun in the beginning of Death of a Salesman.
Is there?
No, but because you, Dave, you call your play Death of a Salesman.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
You bet he better be dead by the end.
Yeah.
They kind of point it out in a fun way, I feel like, in Shaun of the Dead, too, with the Winchester is the pub, and there's just always the gun in the Winchester, and then eventually they shoot zombies with
the
Winchester.
Edgar Wright is really good at sort of going against the grain there. Mm-hmm. With that last movie that he did at World's End, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Or The World's End, that at the end of that movie, you don't go back to homeostasis, that everything is fucked at the end of that movie. And there is sort of like this weird unsettling feeling to that when that narrative doesn't construct or doesn't conform to Dan Harmon's rules, that it's just out there that you can end a movie with everything having gone wrong, and then you feel strange because you're, because you want to believe in the movie almost a little bit more. You want to say, well, but how can that be true? I don't see that around me right now. The world's not in an apocalypse. You can't really accept that that's a different universe. You want to believe, oh, and maybe that actually happened, and that's how we got, that's how the leopard got its spots in the world that we live in now.
It's true, noticing it when it's not there. Like, I won't spoil Jurassic World, but I will mention the Chekhov's gun things that really rub me the wrong way. And there are plenty of examples, but in the beginning of this movie, one of the child protagonists, we see him talking to his girlfriend, who seems like she only loves him, and they're going away. He's going to Jurassic World, and she's going some other fucking place. And she's like, I love you. And he goes, okay. And they didn't say I love you back, and they showed me that moment. And because the movie showed me that moment, something needs to happen. He needs to either by the end of the movie say, you know what, I really love you, girlfriend who did not warrant a name in this movie. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that is part of his arc. The second thing is we see him at the park. Anytime he sees a young woman his age, like, leers at them in a sexual way and is called out on it by his brother. These are two Chekhov's guns that are never fired. Like, he's got these weird issues with his girlfriend, and then he's got these weird issues with strange women, and then dinosaurs happen, so he just forgets. As one, and then at the end, he's fucking fine. But there's never a scene where he's like, you know what, seeing those two female dinosaurs made me realize that I should stop leering at women. I've really grown and learned something today. Or being this close to death, as I've been many times, makes me really appreciate my girlfriend who's so sweet. I'm going to tell her that more, because what if the last thing I said to her was, all right, after she said I love you. No, none of that shit comes back. And you notice that and you feel it because rules are so ingrained. Like, I don't think you don't need to be a maniac about structure like I am to just notice, oh yeah, that's a weird thing. Why would they show me that if they weren't going to do anything? Why would they throw the pizza up in the air in the beginning of Attack of the Rotten Tomatoes? It was not going to come down on Clooney's head an hour and a half later.
Well, then they're just rules that all movies abide by. And when a movie doesn't abide by those, they're not movies that we're necessarily even bored by or that feel stale ever, because we just love them in our narratives. And if we don't get them, then we almost feel cheated by it. It's to the point where if I see people in a car talking in a car during a scene, I've been trained to believe that that car is going to crash at some point, or it's going to veer, or something terrible is going to happen, because there's no other reason to set your scene in a car. So when you see, even like in nice or sentimental movies, 50-50 or whatever, there are scenes in those cars where it's very, very tense for only me, maybe. Because anytime they take their eye off the road, I'm like, yeah, now you have to crash. These are the rules. These are the rules of a movie. And when nobody falls through, it's like you feel drained and exhausted for something that never paid off.
Yeah. Yeah. Just don't show me those things. Like, if you're starting a movie and you're like, hey, we're best friends, I just wanted to show you this gun that I have that shoots rabbits. I just invented it and it exists. Okay, what did you want to talk about? Oh, not that rabbit gun. And then the movie continues and it's just like this weird love story that, and then we never see that rabbit gun in action. Yeah. Just cut out the opening dialogue about the rabbit gun and then I won't obsess over it.
When it really throws me when they bring in something like that. They like start it too late too. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember I saw the movie Georgia Rule, if you've ever seen that movie.
Ooh, more rules. Go on.
Lindsay Lohan is in that movie and just is doing her thing as an unhappy daughter through most of the movie. And then more than halfway through, she just randomly reveals to someone that she was sexually assaulted when she was a kid. And it never pays off. There's no reason for it. But even if it wasn't as shocking of a plot point as that, it's too late to like start a thing like that and never pay it off.
Right.
And just stop whatever you were working on.
Right, like she's suddenly doing an improv game and the rest of the cast is like, no, I think we're pretty committed to this family bonding movie that we've been doing for a couple of days.
Just pointing to scripts by the camera like, no.
So there's one set of directors that I think violates this rule a lot, but they do it very, very successfully, or these rules of movies a lot, and do it very successfully, and that's the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And the Coen brothers, it's because they operate under a different rule that's specifically in opposition to that.
Yeah.
They've said before that they never outline anything. They don't outline their movies before they make them, because they say, if we don't know what's going to happen next, then an audience can't get ahead of us. Like, they can't be, they'll always be surprised by whatever we do next. So they can be fundamentally aware of how movies actually work and everything, but along the way, they're letting the characters guide what happens, and that's awesome.
That's from when they're writing the script, or
when they're writing the script. Yeah, they don't storyboard. They don't create an actual outline first. They don't always go from like scene A to, and then now what happens in scene B. They'll kind of know what maybe will happen in scene B, but they're not trying to get from the very beginning of the story to the very end of the story. They're starting a story and seeing where it goes.
Yeah, I remember the kind of famous story. They were working on one movie and they just couldn't figure out what to do with it. And this was the movie they were supposed to be making right now. This is the screenplay they were supposed to be writing. And they're like, I can't really do this. And then they just stopped and started writing a screenplay about a person who couldn't write a screenplay because they had writer's block.
Yeah.
And Barton Fink exists now.
Because they were hung up on Miller's Crossing. They couldn't figure out how to break that and how to turn it into... And Miller's Crossing actually has a pretty standard shape to it, I think. So it's interesting that they couldn't get there right away, but they made a movie about not being able to do it.
I mean, I guess once you have that ingrained in you, you know movies well enough, that's the path that you know exists, and it's a well-worn path, and you're allowed to deviate from it and wander around if you want, as long as you can still see that path.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that that story has such that has that structure to it. It's just that the terrain around it was just too complicated, and they're like, well, we'll just fucking stick to the path then. We'll make Miller's Crossing.
Well, and also I think one thing that helps you break it, because we're this set structure can be so comforting, and so it helps to break it if you have a certain amount of almost nihilism to your approach to the story and what you think it means. Like with the Coen brothers, I think of Burn After Reading, to me, is a movie about everybody is dumb in the world.
Yeah.
So it can end in everybody kind of, I'm not going to spoil it, just nothing can work out for anyone.
Yeah.
And if that's what the movie's about, it's fine. Or even like with Dan Harmon, like he makes Rick and Morty with Justin Roiland, and there's some episodes of that will just end with Morty buries his own body in the backyard and walks back into the house and has to think about it.
Yeah.
And that's how the episode ends, because they're just willing to be that dark about it.
Yeah, I think that they probably made No Country for Old Men just because of how, and spoiler, how the protagonist dies off screen in that. I mean, even if you read the book, Cormac McCarthy's book, Cormac McCarthy messes with it as well, the structure as well, where a chapter just begins with the main character dead.
Yeah, as much as something can happen off screen, Cormac McCarthy did it with No Country for Old Men, where it's just Sheriff Bell standing over the body of
your hero.
Moss? Llewellyn Moss?
Llewellyn something.
Yeah.
And Davis.
You know, you have to...
No.
Nope. Have to read it a few times and be like, wait, no, but is that the same guy? Like, I was hanging out with him for, like, it's Cormac McCarthy book, 900 fucking pages. Why,
right.
I didn't even get to see him die. That's absurd.
So you pull yourself out of the magic or the rules of fiction, and now you put yourself in the rules of the real world, which are people die off screen all the time, and then you don't know what to do anymore. And, like, that's intentional.
Coen brothers have to be an exception because they're probably the best filmmakers, screenwriters around right now, as far as, you know, for my money, whatever that's worth. His money is no object to me, so I can't really tell.
Well, because also I feel like part of especially Dan Harmon laying out his structure so much, or Lennon and Grant laying it out so much, is they say that, like, you can break these rules, but as you're learning to write, like, as you're learning this craft, as you're learning to do it at all, it helps to build the cart with four wheels and all the parts.
Yeah.
Like, it helps to get good at that, to know what you're doing when you're busting it.
The most helpful thing in the world when I've worked on an episode of a thing for Cracked or a pilot or whatever it's going to be, just knowing what a easy and satisfying crutch it will be to have in the first 10 pages or one page, depending on the size of the script, protagonist says, boy, it sure would be great if I had this. Or, here's my biggest fear that I bet I'll never face. Because then you know, okay, good, I know how this fucking ends. He gets the thing, or doesn't get the thing, but learns something as a result, or faces his biggest fear.
Yeah.
Or it's No Country for Old Men, and he died in the middle, and now it's about this other thing that happened instead.
There's even one Channel 101 pilot that Dan Harmon did called The Lynx. And The Lynx, in The Lynx, there are titles on screen to tell you which step of story structure has just happened at that moment.
Dick.
And it's because the story of The Lynx is a horrible premise. It's about a guy who is an ordinary guy, and when he masturbates and holds a prosthetic leg, when he finishes masturbating, he gains the powers of a lynx. Like, he can run faster and claw people and stuff like that. And so he goes and saves the day by masturbating himself to lynx powers. And it's horrible, but he just says it's like every story, you just fit the things. Here's him crossing the threshold, here's all the things for my just awful premise. It works no matter what.
Yeah, good point, Dan.
He said to himself.
Yeah. I like focusing on shows where the rules are so simple. That's what's great about Coyote and Roadrunner, but I also, Trey Parker and Matt Stone did that great lecture at some school, maybe NYU, but maybe somewhere else, about how their story structure goes when they're writing a South Park episode, that their most important word is because. I might get that wrong, but they never use and. It's never thing happens and other thing happens.
Mm.
And it's always thing A happens. Because of that, this has to happen. As a result of that, this happens. Yeah, the importance of therefore and but is the writing advice that they give. This happens, therefore this, but this. It's such a simple, like, incredibly difficult thing to think of first. You know, I can write a scene where stuff like that happens, but I never even think about it in those efficient terms until I heard them say it. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Anytime that is not therefore or but, it's just meandering. It's just, it's a scene that will get cut by someone else later.
Yeah, because there's also, there's a list of, it's 22 rules that Pixar uses, is a famous list. And it's kind of a mix of how they tell their stories and also just, like, good writing practices. Mm-hmm. But one of them is to always prioritize things that the story needs over just things you would really like to write. And mm-hmm. I feel like if you use that therefore and but, you avoid a lot of things you would just like to write, because I feel like whenever I do those, it's always character does this thing and he like yeah. we do yeah. this spinning yeah. shot that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. Like, it's going to be so great.
Add tangential when to shoehorn it in just because yeah. you light your precious with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I, at the end of almost every scene in an episode of a studio show that I've done, or Agents of Crack even back then, the end of almost every scene, the first draft would have, here's where the scene ends, and then these two, you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and walk in, and they just talk about fucking nothing for a while. It's just like, well, now I'll just throw in some jokes for these characters that don't need to exist.
Right.
And that's immediately cut.
Hey, we're all very lucky that we got to learn how basic story structure works without the internet. Like, that we got to yeah. grow up learning that stuff, because the first thing you do when you start to write or create is you emulate, and you will start to copy somebody else, and you will borrow it wholesale. I know Dan told girls that he wrote the song Brick by Ben Folds 5.
I feel like that's not related to what we're talking right. about.
I wrote a short story when I was probably 12 that was just The Walls Came Down by the Traveling Wilburys. So you steal, and you have to, because that's how you learn it. Like yeah. by tracing it first, and then later realizing, oh, okay, I see how this works. And then you can start to deviate from it. And you always have to come back to that. I mean, if you ever feel like you've deviated too far, then you have to certainly come back to this one. Not necessarily copying somebody, but knowing what the general structure was. And nobody has that really anymore, because people immediately want to put whatever they create up, and they want people yeah. to see it. And that's how you get these people who are defamed for their entire life. That's how you get Shia LaBeouf, who didn't know how to write anything, started to try and write something and thought that he was doing something okay, and then ended up yeah. just borrowing something wholesale from another artist. And everybody was like, fuck you.
I would write out the lyrics to Brick and say, like, I wrote this about you. I didn't like point to a song on the radio. And
no,
like,
no. I mean, that's what I mean. Yeah, you okay. wrote it out. You wrote out the lyrics.
Okay, I hear it now that mine is not better.
The song's dark, right? The
song, yeah.
I even, okay. I knew.
I thought it was really pretty.
I knew so, that I had
it's about Christmas.
I knew that I had cut. You didn't know the song was about abortion at all.
No. And I was a huge Ben Folds 5 fan at the time, and here's what fucked me up, is that he said in an interview in one of the magazines that came to our house that it was about going to the vet. Like, that was his running joke for a while. He didn't talk about it being an abortion until, I think, the Ben Folds Live album came out. But for a while, he was like, oh, yeah, no, it sounds like that, but it's about going to the vet. And I was like, that works. I'm 12.
Yeah, I remember copying When the Walls Came Down, because there is sort of a narrative to that song, and like filling in the gaps for myself, because it gets very vague towards the end. But then afterwards, hiding the cassette in my house, because being fully aware that I had copied this story, and being like, well, nobody else in my house can hear it.
Do you think you had the only copy in the world?
Yeah, me out in the snow, I'm little Danny at the Overlook Hotel covering my tracks so no one can see which way I went.
I remember writing fiction based on characters in computer games I was playing, mm-hmm. because those games have stories, but they tend not to be very good. So yeah. I felt like I was nailing it, because I was like, oh, we can take this story. And like, I just slightly changed it a little bit. I'm amazing. I'm so good at this.
Well, that's the appeal of fan fiction, too, is that you have these worlds that are already built for you. You don't realize how complicated and hard it is to create this whole structure.
Yeah.
And instead, you just take these two worlds that are so carefully and painfully, painstakingly constructed, and then just make them fuck each other. Just like throw them together at each other and be like, look what I did, everyone.
That works in non-fan fiction too. You could just do that in like your screenplay. I want a screenplay that ends that way, that it's someone who came up in fan fiction and wrote a whole movie with characters that are believable, and at the end is just like, no, and then they fuck until everyone's tired. I mean, that's how it used to go.
And the outline says, these characters fuck because they were in the same room.
Yeah.
So, because that's basically the they run into each other someplace, yeah. and then yeah. that's the fan fiction.
Ash from
that's
Dragon it. Ball Z and or fucking I'm gonna take that again.
I almost didn't catch that, because that's the bare minimum I know about both Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon, yeah, is that Ash belongs to the other property.
When I first got into magic, it was an underground phenomenon. Now everybody's like, pick a card, any card.
I shot my full load with the first hand I played. I'd be a monkey in a box hanging with the David Blaines. I'd be swimming.
Kickstart your new year and challenge yourself to learn something new with a free 10-day trial to lynda.com. Lynda.com is used by millions of people around the world and has over 3,000 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, and business, as well as software training like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop. All of their courses are taught by experts, and new courses are added to the site every week. Whether you want to set new financial goals, find work-life balance, invest in a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, find a new job, or improve upon your current job skills in 2015, Lynda has something for everyone. Sign up for your free 10-day trial today by visiting lynda.com/cracked, and you'll get unlimited access to every course on lynda.com. Access to view tutorials on tablets and iPhone plus Android mobile devices. Access to new courses added every week. Some of the courses and videos I personally recommend are Getting Things Done, Business Writing Fundamentals, Small Business Secrets, Breaking Out of a Rut, Foundations of Photography, Exposure and Composition. Do something good for yourself in 2015 and sign up for a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/cracked. That's Lynda with a Y. Go ahead. I challenge you to learn something new in 2015. Yeah, nobody really likes shaving, right? It's a pain. It's uncomfortable. I get razor burn every time I do it, and it's also always more expensive than you want. Except with Harry's. Harry's is about half of the price of the other big branded blades, and they ship for free right to your front doorstep. And they're better, too. Their first blades were made in Germany, and they like them so much that Harry's just bought the entire factory there. Why are you paying $32 for an 8-pack of blades? It's half the price at Harry's, and with Harry's you'll get a better shave that respects your skin, face, legs, and your wallet, and your soul. No more poor quality blades, and no pesky plexiglass cabinets to unlock either. I don't know why they lock those blades up all the time. There's not government secrets in there. The starter set at Harry's is an amazing deal for $15. You get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with the promo code CRACKED, you can get $5 off that for an amazing deal. Men, women, very tall children, we all need razors that shave well and don't suck. I am just furious even going to a store to have to buy them, so it's amazing that I could just, with the click of a button, have these razors sent directly to my door, and they're cheaper, and they're better, and I don't have to interact with anyone to get them. So go to harrys.com now, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code CRACKED with your first purchase. That's harrys.com, and enter coupon code CRACKED at checkout for $5 off, and start shaving better today.
Never paid attention, but I can't afford to laugh, because I'm looking for my break and an autograph for my cast. But I'm short on staff, so all I ask is volunteers in the crowd. Show a little bit of audience participation now. When I say hip, you say shut the fuck up, we ain't saying shit, and I respect it. Check it. Get a flare for the dramatic exit. A fashionable entrance late to my own arraignment. Oh,
you guys, are there other shows that exist now or through time where you feel like you can clearly isolate, like, rules or points of view? Like, Odd Couple is the clearest for me, and everything that has followed Odd Couple as a point of view show where this guy is neat and this guy is dirty, period. That is the show. Put them anywhere. Give them any domestic dispute that they could have. And that's you've got 900 episodes out of that.
Yeah, it's just amazing that actually works. Like, you can have legs that last that long because you do something so simple. If you just try that as an exercise right now and you're like, all right, and let's give two guys characteristics, and then you try to think of a bunch of episodes to go along with that, there are a lot of them that you'd be like, okay, well, we probably get 2.5 episodes out of that. But just neat and dirty, somehow that just clicked and it worked, and you can do whatever you want with it.
Well, in terms of structures being reusable, I always think of the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. I enjoy that movie very much. It totally works for me, and it's got just so many pieces and structures from other things. Like, it's a reboot of the original version of an old series, and it takes so much Star Wars plotting, and it's like so many things you've already seen in one package, and it's great. Yeah. It's really comforting and effective and enjoyable, and just is, I think, a totally.
It's almost like the
movie.
Best fan fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
The very best version, like what all fan fiction it tries to achieve.
That's someone from our forums, I forget who, but he and I were talking about this when Star Trek came out, as the Star Trek reboot being sort of should be the death of parody movies, because the parody movies that had been existing were Scary Movie and the like, all those date movies and epic movies, those things that didn't work, and how they missed what was so great about movies like Airplane, which clearly loved its source material so much, and that's why it existed that way. And then Star Trek came out and was like, oh, this is sort of the new parody because it loves its source material, and it's also winking at it. It's doing the jokes it's doing red shirt jokes in your actual fucking Star Trek movie, and it's doing sword fighting jokes. It's doing all these things that a parody would do, but they're doing it with a wink and like, hey, we love this too. Even though I get to make Star Trek, I still also see why Star Trek is silly, and I'm going to give you a bunch of in-jokes about it.
And also, I think they did that well in the first one of those and not so well in Into Darkness. And I think the switch was they started hanging the plot on it in Into Darkness. Like, they started, oh, we need to come to the big moment where Spock does the yelling for his friend instead of Kirk. That's the center of the movie. But in the first movie, it was just about, oh, he has a red shirt. That's fun. Yeah. Anyway, let's get on with Kirk maturing and becoming a captain and so on.
It turns out I know nothing because because just listening to that, I like all those moments from that movie. I love all those moments. But you're absolutely right that if you followed the format of like the but and therefore, those don't matter. Those would be the first things you would cut out of that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Into Darkness, and I don't want to come down hard on this because I actually really enjoy this movie. I know people didn't love it, but it's from an efficiency standpoint, it's really rough. I mean, if you just sort of chart that movie, Kirk and Spock are on a planet and they do something that they shouldn't be doing, then they go back and they get court-martialed. And Kirk is no longer captain, Spock is no longer first mate, and they both get separated in a boardroom scene where it's just announced. Yeah. We don't see the effects of that because then the boardroom gets attacked, and the captain that for whom Kirk was going to be first mate gets killed. It's like, you're first mate, you're captain now. And he's like, okay, I want Spock as my first mate. Completely inefficient. There's no reason to do take the ship away to give it back to you in 5 minutes.
Yeah, and also, and did those like natives pay off? Like the people on that planet?
Never.
No,
it was just to have something bright and actionable at the beginning of the movie.
Because I really thought that would pay off somehow. It was like, oh, they're drawing an Enterprise in the dirt. This is like huge.
I think the payoff to that was Spock's arc. I think that was Spock choosing to die in that, and then like, no, that's got to be, you've got to choose life. I don't know. Maybe I hate that movie. But speaking of things paying off, that and Abrams and Star Trek and Star Wars, it reminds me of Guardians of the Galaxy, which is almost too on the nose for their Chekhov's gun. I found that movie wildly enjoyable, but it starts with this completely not superfluous, but it felt like it was added in a late draft where Chris Pratt as a kid, Star-Lord, is there with his mom who has cancer, and she's like, here's this present, also take my hand, and he doesn't do it, and then he gets sucked up by aliens, and then we don't see the effects of that at all. Like, he doesn't play this movie as a guy who didn't take his mother's hand. He plays this movie as a guy who's has no problem connecting with people. He's the most enthusiastic and likable guy, and he's what makes these people a family. There's no guilt about that. It seems like it was just thrown in there so he can grab Zoe Saldana's hand at the end of the movie and it can mean something, and he can open that present that he didn't open and it can mean something. But otherwise, the movie doesn't need either of those things except for someone to say, you know, in your first act, you don't have a character who wants something or who does something that he can fix and make him redeemable later. It just seems so tacked on. Still love the movie, but just like, you were just doing like an adventure space pirate movie, and that was fine. I didn't need him to learn something by holding a hand.
Yeah, because I was way into that movie, but that specific part of it felt like in Spaceballs when Lone Star like eventually learns that he's a prince. It's just, oh, like, but in that movie they're doing it as a gag kind of, so it's fine. But like,
there really doesn't have a payoff at all. And you're right, he's certainly not the type of person who's very timid around love or like affection or anything like that. It just has no payoff except when at the end where it's like, well, he would have taken her hand anyway. That doesn't mean shit.
Right, because there was that really tiny scene at the collector where they're like, there was one group of people who held hands and they activated the power. Anyway, moving on to the next scene in this movie. Hope that information becomes useful to you.
There is one that I wanted to mention, too, that's from books. Do you guys know books?
Fart Noise.
Black Books, the TV show?
Nope. There's Raymond Chandler is probably the godfather of noir. He wrote a lot of stories about a character named Philip Marlowe. And every hard-boiled detective story you've ever read is built on what Raymond Chandler created with his character. And you probably maybe read The Big Sleep. That's probably the most common one. But Raymond Chandler talks about how he created Philip Marlowe and what that character has to be within that world for him to work. And it's so good that I wanted to share it with you guys. He says, down these mean streets, a man must go who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid. He is the hero. He is everything. He must be a man of honor, by instinct, by inevitability, without thought of it, and certainly without saying it. He must be the best man in his world and a good enough man for any world. He will take no man's money dishonestly and no man's insolence without due and dispassionate revenge. He is a lonely man, and his pride is that you will treat him as a proud man or be very, very sorry you ever saw him. The story is the man's adventure in search of a hidden truth, and it would be no adventure if it did not happen to a man fit for adventure. If there were enough like him, the world would be a very safe place to live in without becoming too dull to be worth living in. I thought that was awesome. Because you think about then any hard-boiled detective story, and it's like,
right.
Or any story where you've got the kind of cool, icy protagonist. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly right. That's what everybody's doing.
It's also neat that he... I mean, that's his explanation in an interview or whatever, or biography, autobiography about what Philip Marlowe is. He also, in The Long Goodbye, has Marlowe basically monologue who he is in that same way. And here it goes. I'm a licensed private investigator. That's my best Marlowe voice. And have been for quite a while. I'm a lone wolf, unmarried, getting middle-aged, and not rich. I've been in jail more than once, and I don't do divorce business. I like liquor and women and chess and a few other things. The cops don't like me too well, but I know a couple I get along with. I'm a native son, born in Santa Rosa. Both parents dead, no brothers or sisters. And when I get knocked off in a dark alley sometime, if it happens, as it could to anyone in my business, and to plenty of people in any business or no business at all these days, nobody will feel that the bottom has dropped out of his or her life.
He's so aware. And that's what I really love, is because I think a lot of people just sort of start blindly and be like, well, this would be kind of an interesting character trait and this. And then you tack on and you build something. And then other people just start with something completely complete.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, I know all the rules of this character. I know what he is. And he has to be all of these things. Otherwise, it won't work.
Right. Rules are the thing that make writing instantly easy and instantly impossible at the same time. It's easy because if you are Raymond Chandler and you create this monologue of who Marlowe is, then, oh, fine. Stick him in fucking Los Angeles and just pick the crime. And because this character is so real and the rules are set, he'll just follow that path. Once you have the rules of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, any moron can make a perfect Roadrunner Coyote episode. That's what makes it easy. What makes it hard is you have to make those rules first. You have to come from that place of wherever magic lives, where the rules come from.
And you can also then, once you know the rules and the magic, you put them in a situation in which they can't adhere to their own rules. In which they're absolutely forced not to. And then you really watch what happens to them, how they either break down or destroy themselves or find out some clever way around it. Once you know the rules, then you can say, okay, well, what's the worst case scenario for this person then?
Because also I'm not that familiar with noir, but what I do know about it is mostly framed by Casablanca and because Humphrey Bogart in that's not a Philip Marlowe story, but his character is so like that. Like other than following a specific love interest, which also pushes all his other rules, it's really, if it's a good enough set, I feel like it travels. Like either you influence other people or you got it from other people, and then that's how the whole story can play. Even if you didn't write it, you'll see it populate elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and it's just the shorthand for this kind of thing is like we would call them not a hero but a anti-hero or something, like, because they're walking through the world and they're not absolutely perfect. But this is such a smart description of what that actually means that I just love it.
And it's also, especially, because also I feel like the audience can have some fun, and it's fun for the audience no matter what to recognize where the story's going and kind of see, oh, this is going to happen, and I knew that. And the more rules help them do that, and especially if it's a rule like the Marlowe one of he's fundamentally good, but he would never say so, something like that. Like, that's such a, thinking of Casablanca, because I know that better, like, you know Rick is going to probably do the right thing, or at least find a way to do the rightest thing in that very difficult scenario. And it's exciting to know that, but he's never said he's a good person ever. Yeah. And so it feels especially satisfying as an audience member to be like, I just figured him out. I'm great.
I feel like this character also, to circle back to Coen Brothers, this character sort of exists in No Country for Old Men, but he's already dead. It's Tommy Lee Jones's father, who's like, this is exactly like what he was when Tommy Lee Jones is talking about him. He's talking about how the world is a world in which the people will put a baby in a trash compactor and how crazy that is. And nothing is right. Nothing's the way it should be. But there are these people who were the best man in that world and good enough for any world. And he talks about that dream that he has at the very end of seeing his dad again. And they're riding horses in the dark and his dad rides up ahead to build a fire. And it's like, oh, yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Speaking of rules... Any more rules?
I pulled us away from TV show rules.
Soren talked about books. I mean,
thanks for falling on that grenade for me. You don't need to, Alex.
The clearest rules to me, the easiest, are in procedurals, like House has mystery in the cold open, and then by this act break, they think they've solved it, but it turns out something is much crazier is happening, and then they think they solve it by this time, and then, of course, 6 minutes left in the episode, they actually solve the case. And it's rules. I'm sure that's true of every Law and Order too, because they're procedurals and they follow the same roadmaps.
But that's so well worn that I understand. I mean, at that point, I'm no longer. I'm exhausted by those shows, because you know that if you watch a CSI, you can pretty much overlay them over one another and get the science montage at the exact same spot. You get the punchlines over the dead body at the exact same spot.
Yeah.
It's the same like watching an episode of Bones, and they find Bones in the first act, and they're like, oh, I wonder who the killer is. And then I just check the guide info on my TV, and I'm like, well, who's the special guest star? Oh, well, Matt LeBlanc, yeah, he killed her. Yeah, he definitely killed her.
I've never actually seen a full episode of Bones, but I just assume everyone on that show is named Bones.
Yeah.
Oh, we found some bones, Bones. Yeah. What do you think of these bones? Well, Bones, let me take a look at those bones.
Bonesy.
Yeah, it was really, really crazy to me because I just had sort of like anecdotally knew about that show, and that the person who, like the heart of the show is this person who specialized in bones. Like they find bones and they diagnose, but they do some reverse engineering. But they also call her Bones. Like that's her name on the show. It's like Bones and Booth are the two people walking around solving the bone crimes.
And every promo picture for that show I've ever seen is the main characters literally posing with a set of bones, like posing with a skeleton. Like, this is the real character, guys. All the bones. Look in your body. It's a story. You know, like, it's like amazing.
I can imagine Alex driving along on the freeway and seeing the billboards that say bones, and then there's people holding bones, and he's just like, well, they're not wrong.
It's what it's about. I do remember distinctly being a kid, and the time I realized that when I'm watching a TV show, if I look at what time it is, I can know how close they are to resolving the issue in this episode. Like I know this possible solution is a red herring if we're only a half hour into an hour of this show. And I can look in the world and realize what's going on in the show. But also, and also at the same time, like I'm equally at the point of like, oh yeah, it's a crime procedural. I know it's going to be at these beats. But so many people aren't. Yeah, so many people either are conscious of it and like it anyway or have no idea. Like millions of people watch those shows every night.
The way you were about cartoons and knowing what a red herring was how I was reading Encyclopedia Brown books based on when certain bits of information were introduced and like why they decided to, oh, Encyclopedia Brown and Sally were hanging out in his garage, and then Fred, Steve, and Bugs Meany, whose shoes were untied, walk in. It's like, Bugs did it, whatever we're talking about.
Right.
That's the clue. The clue is his shoes.
I'm always amazed by the people who don't pick up on those. And it's people who don't spend nearly as much time obsessing over pop culture, obsessing over fictionalized stuff as we probably do. So I have a wife who's got a very ordinary life. She actually like works in nonprofit, and she
saves
cares
a sweet
about
talk for at home
saving
ordinary life,
saving the planet, and doing actual tangible good in the world. And when I watch a movie with her, she's not aware of tropes at all. So it's like when something scary is happening to the protagonist at the 45-minute mark of a movie, she gets actually nervous during that part, and I have to say to her, I have to ruin it for her because that's just who I am. Like, this is our protagonist. Where's the story going to go if this person dies right now?
Right.
This is not a real situation in which there's going to be danger. What you should be looking forward to is the clever way they get out of this.
Yeah.
or if you're watching a movie and all of a sudden the camera will change angle to from behind a bush, and it's sort of a wobbly camera now, and she doesn't get that now that means that somebody is being watched. Like that there are just certain things that you don't pick up unless you watch movies. You know they actually, you're fluent in the language of just seeing it over
just
and over
sees
and over.
It's like, it's a pretty bad shot.
Why would they
should have stayed on the actors for this one?
Right. I mean, she's good. She knows the music. She knows like the stings and things like that, or when they play ominous music and something's about to happen. But she's just a camera shot changing to suggest that maybe they're being watched in some capacity, even if we're not getting the POV of a killer or something. Why would she be aware of that? There's no reason for her to. And so when she doesn't pick up on things in movies, I get very frustrated. And then I have to be like, remind myself, well, no, this is just, this is how people watch movies. And this is the way you're supposed to watch a movie. Don't ruin it for her.
Well, and also I feel like it speaks to nihilism being the way to break tropes like that. Because even as a very like, oh, I'm a very savvy viewer. Like having not read the books, I was watching the first season of Game of Thrones. And I was like, boy, how's Ned Stark going to get out of this one? Ooh, I can't wait to see how. This is going to be neat. This is going to be really cool. When is he going to like backflip off that platform? Or like parkour or something? Like how does... Oh, he's dead. Oh, okay. That's just how this works. That's just, okay, that's what the show's about.
Well, Jon Snow's going to swoop in and put it back on. He just screws it back on. It's like, our family can do this.
They'll fix it in the next episode. There will be something. Right. And that's what people are doing now with, spoiler alert, Jon Snow, is that they're like, everyone's like, no, he can't be dead. He's my favorite. He can't be dead.
Right.
That's not how the rules work.
This is a good way to wrap up this episode, because that's, as much as I love the rules and I find them very satisfying, it's also if they didn't exist, we wouldn't get fun and exciting things like Game of Thrones, because that show is successful for, among other things, breaking the very familiar rules that we've come to know and love. Ned Stark is as the hero, and Jon Snow on his own hero's journey. Just the deviation from these things that, that are so familiar and comfortable to us is what makes this show so exciting. I don't know if you want to call that nihilism or just cheap writing. I don't know.
Yeah, no, maybe. It's not. I mean, he's aware of the rules. Yeah. He knows how story structure works, and he's breaking it intentionally to startle you.
He's very good at tricking you over and over again, and like, it's clear that he could write the most traditional hero's arc story in the world, because he keeps feeding you those elements. Even there are a lot of spoilers, everybody. Getting into, what do you say, you just started watching it?
No, just when I was in the past.
Oh, when you were in the past, yeah. That even got me again reading the books when Prince Oberyn was introduced. No one has been better at making me forget that they killed Ned Stark and Robb Stark than George R.R. Martin.
Yeah.
And most people don't need to convince me that they did that. But he, like, I start Oberyn, I'm like, Oberyn shows up in the same fucking book as Robb Stark. And I still think, oh, good, this guy, he's, like, likable and he's smart and he's savvy. And he's, like, inherently good. That means he'll win. Finally, there will be some justice that this book has prepared me for. There to be no justice forever. But I immediately was like, this is the one. This
well,
is
there's
the
so much hinging on him living, too. There's now you've got Tyrion tied up in his life. So Tyrion only lives if this guy also lives. And so you think, oh, this will be so satisfying. Yeah. And then really just pulls the rug out from under you again and will not offer you the satisfaction you want ever.
Yeah. It's really like, George R. R. Martin hears us, and as soon as someone says, well, I wouldn't kill him, he's like, now I gotta do it. Look what you're doing to me. You can't say that I wouldn't kill someone, because that's a threat to me.
I really like thinking that the theory that was online when Tyrion was sitting in that prison cell and he's talking to his brother about the fucking cousin Lannister who's would only smash beetles all day and was just crushing beetles all the time. And of course, Tyrion's supposed to be talking about God at that point, but he's really talking about the author of these stories in which he lives. And he's talking about George R. R. Martin, who's just this guy who smashed his beetles.
Yeah. And I asked him, why you smash those beetles? And he just smashed the beetles. Yeah. Like, oh, okay. So George, we're not going to get, okay, good.
So, good. For no reason at all, because you can just kill. If you, as long as you can kill something, kill it. And that's George R. R. Martin.
That's another rule. Hey, and welcome to Footnotes. I'd like to again thank my boss, Jack, for letting me fill in. Jack was, of course, on a 14-day cruise with Mythbusters Adam Savage, one of the Beach Boys, and Robert Durst. This episode about rules kind of bounced around all over the place, in flagrant disregard of its own rules, which is, I mean, whatever, it's fine. I'll continue my quest to find the secret rules that govern all of the best things, and in the meantime, the song you heard at the top of the show was The Last Polka by Ben Folds 5. And what you're hearing now is David Grusin's version of the theme from Peter Gunn, originally by Henry Mancini. I just liked Grusin's version better. Peter Gunn was a show about a private eye, and we talked about detectives, so it fits. We also talked about Ben Folds 5, but I'd put that in here regardless because I just love this damn song. You also heard Escape Artist by Sage Francis, because Jack mandates at least some hip-hop in every podcast, so there's that. That's it. Thanks for listening. Please follow all rules. Today's episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design. No matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/cracked today. That's LYNDA.com/cracked for a 10-day free trial.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.